Welcome once again to Word on the Hills, with me, Felicity Sidnell-Reed, my co-host, Gwyn Sheltimer, and our guests this week, Christopher Caniff and Shane Joseph. Each week, we visit with authors, editors, or publishers who have regional or local connections. We hope to find out a little about their lives, what prompts them to write, and give them an opportunity to read some of their work for us. We're very pleased to have Christopher Caniff and Shane Joseph with us today. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Christopher Caniff is the author of short stories and two novels. The latest, A Poor Man's Galapagos, has just been published by Blue Denim Press, and we are happy to have both author and publisher with us today. Chris has been shortlisted for several awards and won the 3-Hour Novel Award, run by LWOT magazine in Montreal. His short fiction has been published in journals such as Descant, and he recently sold 2 radio scripts to the Falcon Picture Group in the USA. Shane Joseph, a well-known Coburg writer, publishes a wide variety of literary fiction at Blue Denim Press and is the author of 6 novels, most recently In the Shadow of the Conquistador. Apart from the connection between author and publisher, we want to find out about the rather surprising one between the two books. I know you're an engineer, Christopher, who graduated from the University of Toronto, and that you're registered to practice in Ontario. Do you still work as an engineer? And how did you come to start writing? Do you think your training as an engineer influences your writing process?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I am still practicing as an engineer, and I saw a lot of similarities when I first started writing between engineering and as a vocation with required training, and so I took that under advisement when I moved forward with my writing by taking the Humber School for Writers correspondence program. Took that twice, and that set me on the path for writing.
So do you think your engineering training has some effect on your process?
Yes, I think it makes me methodical, and because in engineering there's a lot of rules. It's very rule-based with formulas and derivations of formulas, things like that. And in writing, I think there's also established rules of things that work. You know, there's always new ground you can go through, but looking at what works in writing is something that I've been doing through training as mm-hmm. a writer, yes. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I can see that it might have a good effect upon structure.
Yes, right.
Like building a bridge.
Yes, right.
I understand that you wrote A Poor Man's Galapagos during a year you spent in Ecuador. What took you there? Did you have a novel in mind when you went, or did it grow out of your experience there?
That was when I originally went, I intended to read more than write. The writing came out of what I was reading and also what I was experiencing around me at the time. So there were government protests, for example, that were happening while I was there, and that fed into the novel, and that was kind of the germ for the novel, was that one incident with me looking at what was happening with the government protests there. Mm-hmm. So it was a president that had been a few months into a 4-year term, and he was being ousted as president. So
tell us a little about the story and the characters.
Okay, so the novel is told from 2 different perspectives. One is Thomas, who's an irrigation engineering student at a university in Ecuador, and Poor Man's Galapagos is an island off the coast of Ecuador, so that's where he's attending university. The other perspective is Montgomery, his father. So his father is a travel writer, a British travel writer, and he's been largely absent from Thomas's life. So a couple of different conflicts at the beginning of the story. One of them is more of a, with larger social implications, that being war kind of as a reality that he's facing because he's been conscripted into a border war between Ecuador and Peru, which is largely a financial war because of uranium and oil resources that are at the borders. And it's a war that has been fought for 50 years. While I was there, that war ended. But in that 50-year span, there was people being conscripted and sent to these border wars where there was intense fighting. So the other theme sort of is the family. He has an absent father, as I mentioned. His mother is absent from his life. She abandoned him at birth. So he has a stepmother that has been taking care of him. And so she's been a very good mother to him. But he felt betrayed because he learned after a while that she was in fact his stepmother. So this makes him want to learn about his biological mother. And he sees his father as the key to that. His father is accused of embezzling government money and leaves. So then Thomas embarks on a journey to find out more about his father.
Well, that sounds pretty fascinating.
Oh, okay.
How about reading to us from the book?
Okay, sure. So I'll start in chapter 2.
Okay.
Thomas walked beside his father along a wide expanse of barren beach. Montgomery's eyes shone a rich azure, a color mimicking the sea around him as though the hue, continuously absorbed over decades of peering into the water's depths, now emanated from his gaze. Montgomery was still active after 70 years of life, manual labor seeming more a requirement of good health than a burden. The strength of his sun-baked limbs fought his hunched stature with every step. He was still slender, his physical appearance the same as that of the island's farm workers, and Thomas never remembered him otherwise. But Montgomery was a traveler, a writer, an occasional farmer, with protruding ears trapped between the large, turned-up collar of his gray shirt and the wide brim of his sun-bleached Panama hat. His worn sandals revealed crooked toes at the end of long, leathery feet. Minuscule sand crabs scattered away as they walked, burrowing back to the safety of waterlogged homes. "The newspaper accusations, they're chisme," Thomas said. "Worthless gossip."
"I'm glad someone thinks so," Montgomery replied, smiling. "But really, they're more important than you know."
He spoke in English in a faded British accent, which Thomas had been told also permeated his own speech. Thomas tried to comprehend the meaning of his father's words as he looked out over the nearby fields, illuminated by the morning sun, fields that had occupied Montgomery's time between travel writing assignments over the last 50 years.
"You remember," Montgomery continued, "we once worked those fields out there together until we were forced to stop. We collected bananas, plantains, along with my greatest friend Eduardo Delgado, removing them from palm trees using blades tied to poles made of caña sugarcane shoots."
"I remember the heavy poles," Thomas replied, "and how heavy were the straw baskets to collect red coffee berries in yucca." Thomas also remembered that Human Rights Watch had launched a campaign against the practice of employing youth for the harvest, and Montgomery had been forced to send the children home, Thomas included, but they never talked about that. Looking around, Thomas saw the same type of heavy caña pole split down the center had been tied loosely together to form walls, and then placed between straw roofs and sand floors to produce the few distant residences within view. Both the building materials and the land beneath them were free of cost.
"You know, Thomas, this section of land from the cliff down to the area of the Chinchilla Lagoon has been for sale for many years. It was the only land the government ever tried to sell on this island, and the most pristine plot of land here."
"I know, you told me before, but you said this chisme is important for what?"
"Well, what you didn't know is who bought the land."
Perhaps Thomas's father had acquired the funds to purchase the land. Maybe he was not as trustworthy as he would have his son and others believe. Conceivably, the allegations could be true.
"Not you?" Thomas asked. Montgomery grinned. "No, not me. This land you and I once worked together is now desolate and unfarmable. The Alboradas built here a few years ago by that international organization, they never worked. Instead of collecting rainwater runoff for the crops, they backflooded, so all they collect now is seawater. And now this land is all Eduardo's, ready for the hotel he's always wanted to build on it."
Eduardo Delgado, Montgomery's friend of 50 years, had political aspirations beyond his current position as the island's mayor. And perhaps also a part of Eduardo's plans were this proposed hotel and his newly acquired land, with its ancient and new alboradas, artificial U-shaped embankments capturing rainfall runoff to transform normally arid landscapes into tropical sanctuaries, suitable for a wide variety of crops. Thomas had studied them for years by collecting soil samples and perusing aerial photographs. They continued walking in silence, feet dragging through the sand. The last of the black smoke from protest fires was still visible on the horizon, most of the fires extinguished immediately following the morning announcement that the seat of interim presidency was occupied the former president having fled the country with several of his cabinet ministers. "I'm leaving soon," Montgomery said, the light of the sun displaying etchings of age on the corners of his face. "I'll be going to Quito." Now that his father had declared his decision to retire, Thomas never expected they would be apart again. A lifetime of separation was finally over, and their relationship was supposed to begin anew. He had overheard Montgomery telling Veronica that he would help look after Thomas now. "Thomas is 18, Veronica had replied. "He can take care for himself." Her words were spoken mockingly in observance of the fact that everyone, except Montgomery, realized that this resolution had come too late.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Now we'll take a short break.